I'm Ronald Young, and I work as the director of the U.S. Interreligious Committee for Peace in the Middle East. It's a committee since 1987 of American Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders and constituents, now numbering about 2,400 around the United States. There's a, I'm passing around a pad if even that much information, you'd like some more information about the committee and what the committee does, including you could get on, by putting your name on this, you get a newsletter a couple of times a year. Just put your name and address on this pad that's going around. And I'm also circulating a sheet of paper which gives some highlights of things that the committee has done in the 10 years, or now 11 years, since it came into formation in June of 1987. A word about my own background in terms of work on the Middle East. I had worked for 10 years as National Peace Education Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee, which is a Quaker agency, as some of you may know. I'm not a Quaker myself. I'm a Lutheran now, a new Lutheran, last 7 or 8 years. Before that, had grown up in a community church and called myself a general Protestant Christian. In 1982, my wife, Carol Jensen, who is here and is pastor of St. John Lutheran Church in Seattle, and I, and we got the assignment together to be the Middle East representatives for the American Friends Service Committee, to go out in 1982 to live in Amman. We had never been to the Middle East before, so it was quite a sort of culture shock for us to arrive in the Middle East. And I can remember our first evening in the small hotel when as we thought of it then, the minaret went off outside the hotel window, calling Muslim faithful to prayer. And Carol looked up, and we were just very tired, and she said, "Ron, what have we done?" For 3 years, we worked there, traveling in the region, in Jordan, in Israel, in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Egypt, Syria, and Lebanon, with the assignment, which only the Quakers, I think, would think of as a job. The assignment was to meet people and to listen to their views about possibilities for peace, about what they saw as the obstacles, and about how they viewed how the U.S. could be helpful or might not be helpful in that process. We came back in 1985. Carol went to seminary, became a Lutheran pastor, and I began the exploration in 1985 of forming an interreligious committee in the United States to be an encouragement to our own government to play a positive role for peace in the Middle East. And I want to say right at the beginning that the inspiration for doing that came from Israelis and Palestinians and other Arabs we met in the countries we visited, who it was clear by the years we were out there were moving in the direction of accepting the need for a negotiated accommodation. Something that would not have been true if we had been out there in the 60s or the 70s. And not only am I talking about leaders, but I'm talking about, quote, ordinary citizens with whom we came in contact in the different countries. So the inspiration for this work came from there. And I say that in a particular way as an American, where too often I think we think the inspiration for good things comes from here. In this case, clearly, it came from the people who have the most at stake and have suffered the most in this conflict. And their inclination, their sometimes grudging inclination toward a negotiated peace with the other side was the inspiration for the work that I've done since we returned. Really, there are two topics today. One is the Middle East peace process, and the other is interreligious cooperation for peace. And sometimes when I say the name of this organization to people I might meet on an airplane or somewhere, their eyes roll in disbelief. Because both of these concepts, peace in the Middle East and interreligious cooperation for peace, are problematic. I'm not sure which is more problematic. Maybe the second, the interreligious cooperation. But in any case, they're both problematic. What I'll do is share some insights I'd like to offer about the two topics based on my experience, recognizing that these topics are, in a certain sense, infinitely expandable, but certainly are due more time than an hour. One of the things that's often said about the Middle East and the Arab-Israeli conflict is the topic exhausts the people before the people exhaust the topic. That's certainly true about a lot of topics. I think it's true of this one. And then we'll have time for some questions and discussion. First, on the peace process, the Middle East peace process. And now I'm talking about the peace process to resolve the conflict between Israel, the Palestinians, and the Arab states. And I say it that way very consciously because for a long time the conflict was described as the Arab-Israeli conflict, seeming to suggest a conflict, not simply, but a conflict between Israel, the nation, and the Arab states next to it. And the Palestinians were not in the title of the conflict. If you look at bibliographies, up until about the early 1980s in a library, you'll find magazine articles which referred to the Arab-Israeli conflict very commonly, but almost never referred to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And yet, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as you may know, is kind of at the core of the thing. Since the 1980s, there's been a tendency to go in the other direction. That is, once the Palestinians became recognized as so important in the conflict, there's been a tendency among some to refer simply to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and leave the Arab states out of it. And of course, depending on which way you describe the conflict, it looks quite different. One, you have powerful Israel against the Palestinian people, very weak. The other, you have several Arab states vying against the state of Israel. And so there's meaning and some politics involved in each different description. But I prefer to call it the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, giving the three dimensions. Well, this conflict has been a conflict, and it's not the only one. Northern Ireland is another, which for years people were very skeptical. People there in the conflict and people outside the conflict were very skeptical about the possibility of its ever being resolved. I still often run into people in churches and other places who say, oh, it will never be solved. Another version of it, which is historically inaccurate, but still is quite common, is, oh, they've been fighting for thousands of years. Now, historically, that's not true. But in a way, the hardness of the conflict has caused people to sort of project it back even into time and made it a kind of timeless conflict that will never be resolved. That idea of the conflict began to break down in the 70s with Anwar Sadat and Begin, Prime Minister Begin of Israel, Anwar Sadat of Egypt, the speech of Anwar Sadat, the offer to visit Jerusalem, then the process which began very soon, needing quite strong help from the United States in the person then of President Carter, the Camp David process, leading to peace between Egypt, the largest Arab country, and Israel, a peace which was part of a peace. A peace which didn't resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but began a process of, at a minimum, breaking down the possibility of another big war, because without Egypt, the Arabs were less inclined to think of another big war with Israel, but also simply at a psychological level to break down the idea that this conflict is one that could never be resolved. And then the Madrid Peace Conference, 1981, after the war, the coalition, US-UN coalition against Iraq after the invasion of Kuwait, after that war ended, worked by the United States in particular, and in cooperation for the first time in a long time with the then Soviet Union, to call a conference that would begin a process of negotiating an end to the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which eventuated in the Madrid Peace Conference. Madrid being in many ways a significant, but among the significance of Madrid, the place where there had been tremendous, wonderful cooperation between Jews and Muslims before the Inquisition, in those centuries before the Inquisition. Some of the most moving Muslim and important Muslim and Jewish scholarship of that period occurred in concert with each other in the period immediately before the Inquisition. So the Madrid Peace Conference in 91, and then the Oslo process. Speaking to a group of Lutheran clergy, I found a tremendous, you know, interest in this. I mean, in a special way, Lutherans took some pride in the fact that Norway, or at least Norwegian Lutherans, took special pride in the fact that Norway played this very interesting behind-the-scenes role in bringing together Israeli and Palestinian negotiators when the Madrid process had more or less come to a kind of stalemate. And if you want to read a very moving testimony about that, what went on, there's a new book, 1998, Random House, by the title of The Process, by Uri Sevier, who was then the director of the Foreign Ministry of Israel. And he tells his version of the Oslo process. It's really quite an incredible story, including, to me most especially, the relationship which develops between Uri Sevier and Abu Allah, who was the main Palestinian negotiator, to the point of their families being introduced to each other, their daughters meeting, Uri Sevier giving
Abu Ala a Quran which his father had bought, Israeli Jewish now, his father had bought when he studied Arabic in Egypt in the 40s, had bought a Quran. And Uri Sevier gives that Quran, his father's Quran, to Abu Ala on the occasion of Abu Ala's death in Jerusalem. Very moving account. I'll come back to the two of them at the end because this committee is doing something with them in November. Now, all of that said about the beginning of breaking down this concept, the last 16 months have been awful, just awful. Even if you only pay attention to headlines, you know that the peace process has been stopped. And the mood of people, let alone the hard realities underneath the mood of people today, is tremendously discouraged and frustrated on both sides to a large extent. Discouragement, frustration, and despair have begun now to replace or come back into the fore, replacing the beginning of hope and expectations that had come with Madrid and with Oslo. Close up, and what caused this, just to remind ourselves, there were events that happened. It wasn't as if, you know, somehow the thing just got stuck by itself. There was the assassination of Prime Minister Rabin, Israeli Prime Minister Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin, a hard, tough Israeli general who was leading the peace process on the Israeli side, assassinated by a Jewish extremist. There were the bombings in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem by Palestinian extremists, in using religion as part of the basis of why they did what they did, but in any case doing it and causing tremendous shock and anger and fear among Israeli Jews. And then there was that happened in the spring of 96. Rabin was assassinated in fall of 95. And in June 96, you had elections. And you had Israelis voting by a very slim margin for Netanyahu to be the new prime minister rather than Shimon Peres. Israeli politics in terms of this kind of vote breaks down. An easy way to think of it is a third, a third, a third. A third will vote Labor in the sense that people here might vote Democratic no matter what. A third will vote Likud, which is the coalition that Netanyahu heads, and about a third will vote according to what the circumstances are. And the circumstances in the spring of 1996 were fear. And if the peace process was working, why were we having bombings? That's the way our Israelis reacted. More Israelis had been killed since the peace process started by those bombings than in the same number of years before the peace process. So you can feel the mood and the anxiety, and of course it's an anxiety that plays against the history of Israeli anxiety and Jewish anxiety, which goes back longer than 1948, as we should know. So you have the election of Prime Minister Netanyahu heading a Likud government in a coalition with parties that were even to the right of the Likud, that is, to the main body of the Likud. Parties which said no land to the Palestinians, no sharing with the Palestinians, were totally against the peace process. Netanyahu himself didn't run against the peace process. What he did, very cleverly for the situation, with the help, by the way, of the same American advisor who advises the fundamentalist Christians in the United States, one of their advisors, very cleverly came on a platform of, I will continue the peace process, but I will give you security with it. Peres couldn't give you security, I will, but I'll keep the peace process going. He wins by a narrow, very narrow majority and comes to power. Close up, the situation now in these 16 months is in some ways even more discouraging than it seems from here reading the headlines. I mean, if you go there, what you find is even more discouraging. But in some ways it's also more hopeful, and I want to say a word about each of those. More discouraging. When you go today, you find that the economic conditions, the work conditions, the life conditions Palestinians face in Gaza and in a number of the towns and cities in the West Bank are worse than they were when the peace process started. Unemployment is higher. The commercial life is more stultified, more deadened, more oppressed and hardened, even though there's been some flow of development assistance. The conditions Palestinians face in moving from town to town, simple process of kids going, not kids, but college-age students, Palestinian students wanting to going to Beer Zeit University, big university in the West Bank, and coming from Gaza, or even just coming from Hebron in the southern part of the West Bank, they can't get to Beer Zeit when the Israelis close the land in between. The Palestinians now, as a result of Oslo, and this is progress, have self-government in the cities, the main cities, and in Gaza, but the Israelis control almost all of the land in between the towns and cities. So if there's any kind of security crisis or any kind of political confrontation between Israel and the Palestinians, which is a pretty constant thing, the Israelis then make it very difficult for Palestinians to move between the towns, which in some ways is it's now harder for them to move than under the time when Israel occupied the whole area. I mean, in some ways it's built into the process that was agreed to, but the way it is working is making it much worse for the Palestinians. New settlements have been built or expanded on. From the Palestinian point of view, it makes little difference if a new house goes up on the end of an old, on the same block as an old house, I mean another house, or if a new settlement is started. I mean, that is, the areas of land that Israelis are controlling in the West Bank and Gaza, which the Palestinians imagine to be their state, the areas of land the Israelis have been controlling and putting settlements on have been expanding, including the one that got the headlines in East Jerusalem. For the Israelis, the effects of those bombings, I think, unless you're Jewish, unless we're Jewish, or unless we're really in good, close relationship with Jews, I don't think we can understand the effects of those bombings. Nor, I think, can we understand the effect of Arab and Palestinian rhetoric, which despite the peace process, or because the peace process has been stifled, has been fairly raw and antagonistic. We can't appreciate what the effect of the rhetoric, and even more so of those bombings, are on the consciousness of Jews. Because, as I said before, and I think we can try to imagine, the anxiety Jews have about their existence have roots that are so deep, so long in their history as a people, that it's very difficult for non-Jews to appreciate when something happens which seems to threaten or suggest a threat to survival, how that echoes in Jewish bones. Never mind in Jewish minds, in Jewish bones. And that's just not just Israeli Jews, but American Jews too. So that the economic, you know, part of the peace process was Israel was beginning to have contacts with other Arab countries, not just the ones that were immediate around it, beginning to talk to the Gulf states, beginning to talk to Morocco and Tunisia, beginning to go to conferences planning economic cooperation. I mean, there have been two or three of these conferences since the Oslo Agreement in 93, where Israeli businessmen were sitting down with Arab businessmen and starting to make, as both peoples have a long tradition of doing, make deals, you know? Make deals about future business things. Well, that has basically stopped. Even stopped for those Arabs who are not Palestinians. People, a country like Qatar, or Kuwait, or Tunisia, or Morocco. They say, look, the process is stalled, it's not going well, we're not going to get involved in economic cooperation. So they pull back. And this is discouraging, of course, to many Israelis. And also discouraging to many Israelis is Netanyahu's sticking power, that is the current prime minister. That is, despite the fact that it's clear the peace process has stalled, despite the fact that a majority of Israelis understand that Netanyahu is at least as much at fault for the peace process being stalled, and many Israelis would say he's the main one at fault, despite all that, Netanyahu seems to be able to stick it out. Now, part of it is that we're in the old system, just changed in the last election. In the old system, the winning group in the parliament elected the prime minister. But in the last election, the Israelis, quote, made a reform which caused the direct election of the prime minister. So the prime minister is a little bit safer now, politically, from the Knesset, from the parliament, than he would have been under the old system. That's part of the reason. But part of the reason is Netanyahu's cleverness. I mean, images and how he works various things, public opinion and media and so forth. And part of it is the continuing legacy and real feeling of distrust that Israelis have for the Arabs and for the Palestinians. I mean, I've met many American Christians who seem to, you know, feel quite positive toward Arafat. I would suggest that there are very few Israeli Jews, including the ones most active in the peace movement, who feel very positive toward Arafat. So there's that whole thing that fuels Netanyahu's sticking power despite the peace process being stalled. So I say, if you get close, if you think it looks bad from here, when you get close, you say, oh my God, it's worse than what I read.
but it's also more hopeful. And here's some symbols of that, ideas of that. I don't know whether you read about this, but this spring, two things happened which are, in the context of this, the history of this conflict, are utterly, almost miraculous. Ehud Barak, who is an Israeli general and now the head of the Israeli Labor Party, and who could be the next prime minister of Israel, made a statement several months ago in which he said, I think if I were born Palestinian, I would have been a terrorist. Now, for an Israeli Jew, who's now got a political agenda, to say that is an astounding thing. Because for Israelis, for many years, Palestinians were the terrorists. The PLO were the terrorist, was the terrorist organization, which basically meant inhuman monster can't talk with you. And for him to say, if I had been born Palestinian, I think I would have been a terrorist, is a remarkable, showed a remarkable capacity for an Israeli Jew to enter into the story of the other people. In the same time frame, Yasser Arafat visited the home of Anne Frank in the Netherlands. Anne Frank, you know, the Jewish girl who was a victim of the Nazis. And when he came out, he spoke about the unique suffering of the Jewish people and how such suffering should never be visited on children of either of our peoples ever again. Now, Yasser Arafat, this is Yasser Arafat. This is not just a Palestinian mystic or, you know, I mean, this is not someone off to the side. This is someone at the center of power in their respective societies, making statements which totally go against the idea of this conflict, which has existed for several decades. And the idea was that one side would not recognize the other side's existence. That is to say that each side, the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, were committed to making the other side disappear. And not just in rhetoric, but in action. Palestinians wanted Israel to disappear. There are reasons for that. You can look at the history and understand why Palestinians wanted that. You can look at why Jews who came to this land, most of the Jews who led the Zionist movement came out of the experience of the Holocaust, why they could not even tolerate the idea that there was another people with an equal claim to theirs on that land. So each people wanted the other side to disappear. In the context of a conflict which could be described that way for several decades, to have Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat doing these things is an incredible, almost miraculous change. There are ongoing contacts and cooperation between Israeli Jews and Palestinians today that would blow your mind. When Carol and I were out there, traveling back and forth, we frequently met with Israelis and then met with Palestinians, and they would ask us, what did the other one say? Most of the people we met are now talking with each other. They're meeting with each other. Despite what's going on in the peace process, they're meeting and trying to strategize together. When something awful happens, one will call the other and say, how does it look from your side? To help figure out what it is from my side we should do. That's an amazing change. Popular opinion. Today, and it's been true now, and it's been growing since in the last 3, 4, 5 years, the percentage of Israeli Jews who accept the idea of Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza is up at about 65 or 70%. So it's in very deep contradiction with the current government's policy in Israel. But that's a big change. 65-70% of Israelis, they're not saying we think the Palestinians are right and we were wrong, but they are saying we accept the idea of a Palestinian state. A similar percentage or higher of Palestinians have accepted since 1988, certainly since the early 90s, that Israel is here and we're going to accept it, and that what we're going to get is a state in the West Bank and Gaza, which represents only about 25% of Palestine, which Palestinians feel is theirs, and still feel that way, and will for a long, long time, maybe forever. There have been discussions between Israelis and Palestinians and Israelis and other Arabs about solutions to even the most difficult problems that remain on the negotiating agenda, and I use Jerusalem as perhaps the hardest example. There were discussions in 95 and early 96 between Israelis and Palestinians, including people one step down from the top leadership on each side,
which came up with ideas for resolving a way to share Jerusalem and have it the capital for both Palestine and Israel. Now, where are those ideas now? Well, they aren't being voiced by Netanyahu. They aren't being voiced by the current government of Israel. They're not even being voiced by Arafat, because these are negotiating, these are delicate things. But what I'm saying is that there are discussions going on that could, if the politics can be shaken loose, could come to fruition. That is to say, at fairly important political levels on both sides, there have been talks about ways to solve even the most difficult issues. The year ahead is a very important year, partly because how discouraging it's been for the last 16 months means there's tremendous pressure on both sides to move ahead. Israelis want the process to move ahead, most Israelis. 81% of Israeli Jews said they wanted the U.S. to push harder. And they knew what they were talking about. They knew that meant push on Israel as well as the PLO. 81% of Israeli Jews. Again, a contradiction with the government. But we've been in this country in situations where 70 or 80% of the American people wanted something that the government didn't necessarily do. So it's politics, you know. But it's important to keep in mind when the newspaper headlines are so discouraging that 81% of Israelis want pushing from the U.S. They want the process to go forward. Certainly no less than 81% of the Palestinians want pushing from the U.S. So there's pressure from people in that sense. There's also pressure from ahead in the sense that the Oslo process set a goal of May 1999 as a time when the process should be completed, when the tough issues, even Jerusalem, should be resolved. And this is why you have Arafat saying, if they're not resolved by now, he's going to declare a state anyway. He said that on some days, he's pulled it back on some days, but it's hanging over the situation. And even on the Israeli side, if Netanyahu isn't able to make significant progress by May 99, it will be another sign of his failure, because that deadline was set, built into the Oslo process. There's a tremendous need for U.S. leadership, but U.S. leadership of the best kind is not an assured thing. And I'll come back to that at the end. Let me turn to interreligious cooperation for about 10 minutes. If the idea of peace in the Middle East is problematic, the idea of interreligious cooperation for peace in the Middle East is no less problematic. I remember meeting with an interfaith delegation. I once a year lead a group of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders from this country out to meet, go to the different countries and meet different people, get a feeling of the situation. And we had this I had never met with this man before, and so you never know what's going to happen. We met with a man who was in the Peres, in the last government, last Israeli government's cabinet. He's an Orthodox Jew who dresses in the way that when I conjure up an image of Orthodox Jew, I think of, that is black hat, black coat, has the peyas on the sides of his head. And so you immediately carry all your stereotypes into the room with you when you meet. And the first thing this man says, he said, I want to tell you a story of something that happened to me this week. He starts speaking very good English. By the way, he's the rabbi of Norway, beside being Israeli, very important Israeli Orthodox rabbi, and in the cabinet of Israel, in the last government, not in this government. He says, I want to tell you something that happened to me this week. He said, I met this week with the PLO Minister of Information. Now the idea, the picture, I mean it's like a cartoon, you know, the picture of this guy in his regalia meeting the PLO Minister of Information, who would not have been dressed in religious garb, but maybe in an army suit or something, you know. The two of them meeting, and he said, and the PLO Information Minister said to me, you know, Rabbi, he said, I hope you don't consider this disrespectful. He said, but some days I think the peace process would be better off if we took all the religious leaders, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims, and locked them up until we're finished. And this Orthodox rabbi replied, you know, Minister of Information, some days I have the same thought myself. So this is an Orthodox rabbi. But what is that about? That's about both these men, Palestinian and Israeli, recognizing and accepting that religion has been used in this conflict, and not only in this conflict, often as ways to exacerbate the conflict. On the positive side, while we as Christians, most of us probably here, we all may be more confident about our own tradition's core commitment to peace, the fact is that even a limited understanding of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam should convince us, I think would convince us, that the imperative for justice, the imperative for peace, the imperative for reconciliation is at the core of all three religious traditions. Just as an example,
Of all the chapters in the Quran, there is only one that does not begin by naming God as the most, as the merciful and the one who does mercy. Now what more? You know, every chapter of the Quran begins that way. This is God. The merciful one, the one who does mercy. So at the core, and I use that example because we're probably more familiar with Jewish core teachings and Christian core teachings, but at the core of all three traditions is a deep imperative, a fundamental imperative for justice, for peace, for reconciliation. Now some of you may doubt that, and that's worthy of discussion, certainly. I think even a limited reading of each tradition would suggest that that's true. Yet, we also know that all three traditions have been used at different times, in different places, to generate prejudice, and even worse, to justify oppression and murder, if not, and in sometimes including, mass murder. For Christians, regarding Jews, for how long? Blaming the Jews for killing Christ. While at certain levels of our churches, we've made progress about that, where are the attitudes in the pews? How much shudder would there be in how many Christians if the phrase, they killed the Jews, the Jews killed Christ, were to be used? I think we've still got work to be done. Still have work to be done. The new covenant. Well, what happens to the old covenant? The New Testament, the Old Testament, what happens to the old one? Why is it called the old one? It's outdated or something? Obviously it isn't for Jews. But this idea that the new covenant somehow replaces the old covenant, that notion, which of course there's been very good work done, critical work done on it, so that we now, some come to different understandings of that, we don't think of ourselves as somehow being superior to or replacing the Jewish tradition. But that hangs on, doesn't it? The persecution over centuries, you know, all those years when Jews were not allowed to live in certain places. We're not allowed to live in certain places. By the way, that's one of the reasons that Jews get so nervous when Palestinians talk about getting Jews out of the West Bank. Because it echoes that thing of, my God, we can't live there. That's, you know, Jew-free. It'll be Jew-free territory. And then the Holocaust. We can have long discussions about the role or the responsibility of Christianity in, for, and in the Holocaust. But certainly there's something there, isn't there? There's something there. And then how long it's taken us to acknowledge these things. Was it 94 or 95 when our own Lutheran church acknowledged that the teachings of Luther about the Jews needed to be criticized, needed to be, were mistaken, were wrong? Catholic Church still struggling with its responsibility during the Holocaust and what its teachings are about the Jewish people. Christians regarding Muslims. Islam for centuries among most Christians and Christian teachers was viewed as the religion of Satan. I mean, if we have problem with the Jews because they didn't all convert, didn't all see the light, what the hell do we do with the Muslims who found the light 600 years after Jesus, and who, by the way, think it's the last and best light? So what did we do? It's the religion of Satan. It's the religion of Satan. The Quran, I think, was not translated into English until about the 1600s, and then it was translated with a very careful introduction which warned any reader against any truths that could be found there. And the snake-like quality of the text. You should read the Quran and see if you find a snake-like quality in it. It's an amazing book. It's an amazing book. The Crusades, where Christians came to Jerusalem, you know, and got rid of all the Muslims and all the Jews. The Muslims, of course, take pride today in the fact that when they recaptured the city, they allowed the Christians and the Jews to worship there. They invited the Jews back. Saladin very carefully didn't worship in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre because he was afraid his followers would, as soon as he prayed there, make it into a mosque. And he thought it would not be a good idea to make it into a mosque. So he didn't pray in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
the Crusades, the Inquisition, colonialism. How many of you, when you're sitting in church on Sunday morning, you're reading, singing a hymn that's about Christian power worldwide, and Christian, we make the world for Christ, you know? You look down the page and you find that it's written in the 1800s, you know? And maybe in Britain, you know, and where the flag and the cross just went together. And you can see all these Anglican, it's not an Anglican slur at all, it's because it's all of us, you know, but whatever they were, Anglican or whoever, German, English, German, Spanish, whatever, but sitting and proudly singing the hymn, and all their boys were going off to take over this or take over that. Of course, for the good of them, and more for the glory of God. The way that got mixed so easily. Now, we say, but that's 1800s, 1900s, but don't forget, there are victims of that, and they tend to remember longer, just as Jews tend to remember longer than Christians, the Holocaust and the persecution. Why all this negative history? Well, this is another hard part of what we have to know. I think the sources for this go very deep. I think the sources for these problems in how religion has been used go very deep in our texts, our traditions, and our histories. So they are not easily eradicable. For Jews, that concept of chosenness, we're the chosen people, you know, that's a tricky concept. I mean, if you read the scripture, you know that the writers of the scripture knew it was a tricky concept, because they kept emphasizing you're chosen to do righteousness, not because you're so good. But, you know, it can get confused in there. You can begin to think you're chosen because you're something special. And then the history of the Jewish people, with all that suffering, I think I have an understanding now, after the Holocaust, when Jews say never again, to a certain extent, for Jews, that of course means we'll never allow a Holocaust again, but to a certain extent, it also means we'll never accept the moral judgment of others. Now, that's a dangerous proposition. But there is that kind of an attitude of who can tell us anything after the Holocaust? And think about if you were the Jew after the Holocaust. Mightn't you have that inclination? Christians, Christ is the way. Christ is the way, the way, the way. I found it. Christ is the way. The only way? Well, yes, for some. It's very clear. The whole revival in this country among certain, what we call fundamentalist Christians, certainly have that sense about them that, yes, the only way. The only channel of prayer that's open. The only way to salvation. And then that marriage of the church and the empire at Constantine, with Constantine. Oof! You know. When power is joined with faith and the world is yours. Wow. And Muslims. You know, I say to Muslims, I said, you know, you guys are unfortunate because Muhammad came last. What do you mean? Well, because once he comes last, you sort of think he's the cat's meow, you know? He's it. And of course, Muslims say, no, but we respect the Jew. We respect the Jews and the Christians, the people of the book. But there's a problem there. Or there's a sort of inherent inclination when you have the last prophet to think that that's the best, the summary, puts it all together the best way. And of course, it doesn't lead to humility, it leads to a kind of sense of superiority, can lead to a sense of superiority. And then, of course, Muslims have the history of only, 700-800 years ago, when Islam was the main center of civilization. And there's a sense of that golden age. And Arabs today, even still today, sort of wonder, where did it go? Where did it go? I mean, that's the way it should be again. And that, so I'm saying, just in very brief, almost tag-like ways, that the sources for the negative uses of our religion are very deep in our traditions, in our texts, in our histories. Now, despite all that, I believe that the basic reason why there is an interreligious committee for peace in the Middle East after 11 years, six years before the peace process, before Oslo, and throughout these last 16 months of lousy peace process, I think the basic reason there's an interreligious committee is because people in it, the Jews in it, the Christians in it, the Muslims in it, believe that we have to do this even when we can't stand it. Even when we can't stand doing it.
That it's that kind of imperative. It's a faith imperative. It isn't a thing that changes with politics. It is a thing which at its best changes politics. So that the reason that people come to meetings, even though they know it's going to be hard, I mean, every board meeting we've had, and Carol was at the last one out in Silverdale, Washington, it was hell. I mean, it was wonderful, but it was hell. With the Christians with their shtick, and the Jews with their shtick, and the Muslims sort of, in a certain sense, still hanging on the edge, figuring out what to do. I mean, I'm sort of describing the American relationship here. Christians and Jews, we know our place here. We've got our ground underneath us. Muslims are just trying to get their ground underneath them. So this board meeting was a lot of tension, a lot of pressure. Why did people come? I mean, it was, in some sense, the experience was not terrific. Why? I think because they believe that we have to do it, even though we may not be able to stand it. I remember forming the committee, certain people that I went to speak to. Rabbi Eugene Lippman, bless his soul, who's now passed away, who was the head of all Reform rabbis in the United States, who, when I described the project to him, he said, I've not been active on this issue. He had a long tradition of being active on race relations and justice issues and the poor and Cesar Chavez. He said, I have not been active on this issue. But he said, what you're telling me you're trying to do, and not just me, but this project, is the right thing to do, and I will join you. I went to see a Palestinian Muslim American named Dawood Assad, who was born in the village of Deir Yassin, which was wiped out by Israeli irregular forces in 1948, and he lost several members of his family. He was 4 years old, luckily escaped, and wound up living in Jordan. Went to Dawood, had never met him. And as I was talking to him about the project, he said to me, you know, Ronald, he said, you probably don't know this about me, but he said, I am from Deir Yassin. Well, I just fell off the chair. I said, my God. He said, it's okay. It's okay, he said. I just wanted you to know that. He said, but my understanding of Islam is this, what you are trying to do is something that I must do. I must do it. So I will join you. I remember going to see Joan Campbell to ask her, the head of the National Council of Churches, if she'd be the Christian co-chairperson. And Joan had enough on her plate, to say the least. It was all falling off. Head of the National Council of Churches with all the stuff. And Joan just said to me, she said, you know, I really shouldn't do this, but I have to. And so she agreed to be the chairperson. The committee has done several things. It's done simple things like, I say simple, put out prayers for peace by Jews, Christians, and Muslims in one piece of literature. But I've been told that never happened before. That is, prayers for peace in the Middle East by Jews, Christians, and Muslims in one piece of literature that were used by congregations around the country. We've organized these trips to the Middle East for Jews, Christians, and Muslims. We've done conferences in different cities and convocations for peace in different cities. We've recently been doing briefings in cities for interfaith groups on the issues still to be negotiated. And finally, to end it, how does such a committee relate to the U.S. role? I'll say it this way. In the last year, and you may be aware of this, if you remember certain headlines or news items you saw. In the last year, in this country, there has been active interfaith cooperation against peace in the Middle East. Against the U.S. playing an active, creative role in the peace process. That cooperation includes the following groupings. AIPAC, which is the Israeli lobby, that is the group in Washington that essentially lobbies for whatever the Israeli government position is. So it took better positions when Rabin and Peres were prime minister. Now it takes, I consider, worser positions, because it reflects the positions of the current Israeli government. So AIPAC, and a minority of American Jews, probably somewhere around 15 to 20%, no more, who are against the peace process, who don't want peace with the Palestinians, or don't believe it's possible and therefore are not for the peace process. That's one group. Second are partisans in the Congress who are out to use anything they can to get Bill Clinton. And if they can use the peace process, they will. We are not for Bill Clinton pushing Israel. And they think that will gain them votes. And they partly think that will get them votes because many of them are beholden to constituencies in which a large number of fundamentalist American Christians reside, who also are against the peace process for the oddest of reason, in my view. The oddest of reason being
that fundamentalist American Christians, or at least significant leadership of them, are happier when there's confrontation and violence in the Middle East because they see it as signs that the end times are closer. And as an example, when the tunnel was opened in Jerusalem, causing riots, causing the death of 85 people, I heard on one of the prominent radio stations, a Christian evangelical radio station, a discussion where the man finally said, he said, well, you know, he said, arguing about whether Arafat is saying the right thing or Netanyahu is right is not the important thing for us. The important thing is to recognize that this violence that is occurring is a sign that the end time is coming. Glory! Hallelujah! So the Interfaith Coalition Against the Peace Process has been very effective in Washington. It's got Congress on the run. I mean, it's got Congress where it wants it, or a lot of the Congress. Interestingly enough, a lot of the Jewish members are not very happy about this, or some of the Jewish members aren't. You've got the fundamentalist Christians, the partisans who are against Clinton and willing to use the Middle East or any issue they can. You know, Gingrich is willing to use Jerusalem, just play with it like it's a campaign issue, you know? And then you have a percentage of the American Jewish community who are against. And what I think is needed is an expression by majorities of American Jews and Christians and Muslims, both separately and together, which can say in this country that we want our country to play an active, creative role in helping Israel and the Palestinians and the Arab states complete the peace process. I don't think that's too much to ask of us, but so far it isn't happening strongly enough. I'll stop there. Please, I mean, obviously I've touched on all kinds of things, and I would just welcome you asking or commenting or asking a question about wherever you come in on this.
Why does America have to run the show all the time?
Good. I wish that somebody else would.
I do too.
Let's look at two different specific issues about that. Why couldn't Norway take this on entirely? Basically, what happened was Norway was able, because it is small and in a certain sense out of the way, and has reasonably good relations both with Palestinians and with Jews, with Israel and with Jewish people, it was able to do something quietly and positively. It was of great significance. In fact, Norway and Sweden and Denmark are all continuing that work. There's a very important thing called the Copenhagen Declaration that the Danes arranged with help from the foreign ministry, where Israelis and Palestinians and Egyptians and Lebanese and Jordanians, I don't think there were any Syrians, have come out with a statement about what would the peace look like. But the fact is, when they reached the agreement in Oslo, they needed an elephant to support it. And so they came to us. In other words, they needed something that represented substantial power. They fought. Now you might argue they're wrong, but I'm saying this is their reason. They felt they needed something that represented substantial power to back that agreement. So they chose the White House lawn as the place to have it. So that's a reason why another country might not be able to do it. The UN is another story. The UN is a complex story. Obviously, the UN has been involved in the conflict since the beginning. The fact is that the resolutions on which this peace process and the Israeli-Egyptian peace process is built, or were built, are resolutions of the United Nations Security Council, Resolution 242 and 338, which call for Israeli withdrawal from occupied territories that it occupied in the 67 war in exchange for peace and security of all states in the region. That's the bedrock principle on which all the negotiations are based. So the UN's involved. But the UN is looked at much more positively on the Arab side than on the Israeli side, partly because there have been a series of what I would call political resolutions adopted in the UN that is political in the sense that they didn't have real force, but they expressed opinion, a series of political resolutions adopted in the UN which were unfavorable to Israel and favorable to the Palestinians. Well, that means that if you went to try to get the UN involved, if Kofi Annan tries to get the UN involved some way, the Israelis are going to be much more standoffish than the Arab side. And so, you know, if both sides don't accept that the UN plays the role, then it doesn't work. Why do they look to the US? We're big. We're very wealthy. We're very influential. We have economic power. We have military power. We have diplomatic power. We're involved in the region in a number of ways. There are a number of things that, as the peace process succeeds, a number of countries will want to develop with the U.S., including trade relations. So, you know, it's not just that they think we are, like they looked around and said, who's the best at conflict resolution in the world today, you know? They're looking for a helpful elephant. And here we are. I wish there were another. But we've got a certain responsibility that, with that.
Who's the rabbi in Oslo?
Who's who?
The rabbi in Oslo you mentioned.
Yes, I can only think of his first name. His first name's Michael, and I'll try to. I was trying to think of it before, but I couldn't. I'll try for you because he's just marvelous fellow. Yes.
There is another elephant by default. We probably prefer BS, and that you could conceivably see the Soviet Union as another elephant, but. My question was, what, if any role, Russia. What, if any role, Russia currently plays in?
Russia has so many problems. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it was a tremendous, I mean, I'm going to say something in parentheses that is a whole other topic. The cost of the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States will take a century to get over. Mm-hmm. The cost in terms of the poor in our cities, the cost in terms of conflicts around the world, like this
and
one.
The sides we took. Here.
Yes, because in the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict for years, the Soviet Union and the United States didn't try to work together to resolve the conflict. They tried to work the conflict to gain advantage over the other. And you'll meet Israelis, Abayiban is one, who's very condemnatory of that, and realize that Israel suffered terribly, not just the Arabs, because of that. But what happened was, with the end of the Cold War, U.S.-Soviet Union did cooperate on the Madrid peace process, but then subsequently the Soviet Union was gone. So the trouble, I mean, I don't know if it's a trouble. A reality today is that there isn't quite another elephant in the same sense that the U.S. is it. I'm using this phrase, elephant. That's a very sort of almost silly. Yes?
It seems to me that right now you're talking about, I mean, ideally having the West Bank, Gaza, just having two ethnically distinct nation states side by side. But it seems to me the reality is they're so intertwined and dependent on each other that that can't be anything more than a temporary solution. Do you think there's any chance in 100 years that there might be one nation state of Palestine with an ethnically diverse population that accepts one another? Or will the Jews never relinquish control of a government of their own?
It was an idea that a few Jews back in the 40s had, and some Palestinians had back then, but it was an idea that couldn't go. I think it couldn't go, probably couldn't go on both sides. It couldn't go certainly on the Jewish side, because what Jews felt they needed after the Holocaust, especially after the Holocaust, though since the 1900s, I mean, Zionism, remember, Jewish nationalism begins in the 1800s, not 1942. But Jews felt for a century, and then the Holocaust sort of said, we were right, in a way that was undeniable to most Jews, that we need a place of our own, we need a state of our own, we need a government that is ours. Now, ironically, of course, the government came into being with a lot of help from the outside. So that the idea that somehow the Jewish state is totally non-dependent on others has always been a myth, but it's been a very important myth. It's been a very important myth. And the sense that this is ours and it's Jewish is very important. And as non-Jews, I think we probably need to take that in quite a while before we too easily suggest that maybe there's something better. That is why Jews need that. I think for Palestinians, their need to have something separate from Jews has increased in a certain sense with the conflict. So Palestinian nationalism, both in regard to the other Arabs and in regard to the Jews, has become more intense over the last decades. So they have their own need now for a place that is their own. But the interesting thing is that once Madrid happened, once Oslo happened, you had discussions going on that was crossing those lines all over the place. I mean, that is, you had Jews, Israeli Jews and Palestinians, talking about very low, soft borders. Immediately. Because they saw what you saw. They weren't saying one state, but they were saying maximum cooperation. Minimal border. Security border, yes. But economic, cultural, da-da-da-da-da. We've got to have it. And Jordan the same way. I mean, Jordan, at least certain of the leadership in Jordan, including the king, has for years recognized this and been looking to the day when we begin to talk a lot of cooperation. And some of that has, where it is now, is basically underground. because it's very unpopular. Once the peace process is stuck the way it is, it's not very popular to say, hey, let's have a big cooperation project, you know? And everybody's sort of sour and down and frustrated. So it's now sort of underground, but there are still things going on. There's a grant, for instance, that our own AID gave, I think 150 million or I don't know, something, some figure that I don't deal with where I am, where the Jordanian Ministry of Education, the Palestinian Ministry of Education, and the Israeli Ministry of Education are reviewing their school curriculums in light of the peace process. That is to say, do you teach the same things in your school when you're fighting a war for survival as you do when there's peace? No. Now, I'll bet that project has run into snags, because the group of teachers you bring together are under pressures from home that, you know, you can't go forward with that. But so I think, Palestinians and Jordanians have been talking confederation. There's talk of confederation, Israel, Palestine, Jordan. I think that is the next step, and that step, how long that step would last before something else happened, I don't know. But it's there, and in some ways, you know, it was quite amazing. Once people accepted that the other side is here to stay and we have to accommodate, there were a lot of people who saw the logic of that in terms of, well, cooperate. I mean, accommodate means cooperate in a small in a situation where we're so tightly bound to each other as this. Yes?
Would you say that all of the Arab nations are unanimously behind the Palestinian nationalism?
Well, if you know, the Palestinian answer to that is depending on circumstances, but yes and no. I mean, Palestinians can give answers to that are very harsh on the Arab nations. And I don't mean that I'm not judging their response. I'm saying they'd give a very harsh no answer. Arab states have given us nothing, they would say. I think other Palestinians in a little bit more objective mode would say the Arab states have in fact been supportive in some ways, but in very limited ways, or in limited ways, that they have never, no Arab state has put the Palestinian cause first. Well, what state puts the cause of another people first, right? But Arab leaders have made great rhetorical statements about the Palestinians, Palestine, 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 while Palestinians were maybe number three, number four, number five on priorities. And if it came to a choice of basic state interests or regime interests, the regime of Hafez al-Assad versus the Palestinians, it wasn't the Palestinians who were going to get first bidding. So they've been supportive. They took Palestinians in. I mean, we know Arab families who took Palestinians in their homes in 1948 and were very moved by that experience and very identified with the Palestinian struggle because of that. We know that Arab states have hosted refugee camps and allowed some Palestinians to work. Jordan is the only Arab country that allowed Palestinians to actually get citizenship, where they did. Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, Palestinians remain as stateless. So the Arab, you know, the Arab states have been mixed. Rhetorically, they've been there. But reality, less so, mixed. Some support, but never giving the Palestinians first priority. Which I guess, I mean, you can be disappointed in it, but then you have to look around and say, what state gives some other people first priority? Yes?
Do you have any antagonism toward yourself, you know, becoming
antagonism toward
you being a Lutheran? Because, you know, here's the Lutherans were the ones who really created the Holocaust. You know, they blame it on Hitler, but it's the Lutherans who did this.
Well, I guess...
I'm excluding Bonhoeffer. There's a lot of really dedicated guys, but I mean the majority of the Lutheran ministry supported this.
Well, I guess as a non, maybe as a new Lutheran, I feel able to say this maybe more than, I don't know, not more than Lutheran, but I'll just say, I think the causes go much deeper than that. I mean, I think the causes go deep in Christendom. And I say Christendom in the sense of meaning the wedding of faith and power, and they go deep in that early separation of the church from the synagogue. And that was not Lutheran, you know. That was not Lutheran. I mean, so the sources go into our own misuse of the text. I remember someone once, a relative actually asked me, Ron, what's the most important thing to you about being religious? No, you know, once in a while someone asks you a question that you've never been asked before. It's marvelous when that happens. And I said to him, I said, you know, Max, I said, I think the most important thing to me is the sense that it makes me feel or reminds me of that I need to be humble. And I said I partly learned this, I think, working in the Middle East and working with Israelis and Palestinians, that the alternative for many people, I think, is that what the most important thing religion gives them is a sense of certainty as compared to humility. And you know, certainty about what is the right way, as compared to if this is true, what we espouse in our faith, my God, it is utterly amazing, you know? It is utterly amazing. I am so overwhelmed by it. I am not on top of it. This phrase, I found it, as if you know the bumper sticker I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. As if you can hold it in your hand, you know? No, it's the other way around, don't you understand? We are held in the hand. And we are not just we, Swedish Lutherans. But you know, all of us, Jews and Muslims, we're all held in the hand of the one God. That's, of course, what we share with Jews and Muslims, this idea of one God, although try to convince a Muslim of the one God thing when you explain the Trinity, and you got a ways to go. I don't know. I think the sources are much deeper. I think we have to both be critical of ourselves, but also not somehow think it's the Lutherans that did it. I wish it were that simple. I wish it were that simple. Someone, yes.
What is the role that the Palestinian Christians have played in the process? How have they been invited into the process?
Palestinian Christians are between several rocks and several hard places. One of the first that I would mention to us as Americans, one of the first rocks and hard places they're between is the lack of recognition for many years by Western Christians. The anecdote which summed that up is a group of American Christian tourists coming back from Bethlehem to Jerusalem one day, and one rather loud, maybe typically loud American tourist, saying to friends in the group, you know, we were in Bethlehem the whole day and I don't think I saw one Christian. Well, of course, he was buying his olive things from Christians, but they weren't from Indiana, you know. I mean, the idea somehow that, I mean, once, I don't know whether it's related to the Constantine marriage and the church, that once that happened, you get this, somehow this notion that Christ came from the west to the east, you know. So that's a first rock and a hard place. You go out there and you find Palestinians. You know, we visited with a Palestinian who took us to his village, which has been a Christian village since the time of Christ, almost, and it overlooks Krak de Chevalier, the Crusader castle outside of Damascus. And of course, these Christians were sitting up there in his village watching these Crusaders come, you know, who had no regard for them at all. Well, some earlier missionaries, not today, I think, by and large, although some of the evangelicals still have that, or fundamentalists still have it, had no regard for the local Christians. Now, that's been changing, and in fact, our churches, many of our churches are in close connection with Palestinian Christians. So, but that's one rock and a hard place. Another rock and a hard place is they're caught between Muslims and Jews. They are the minority. And it's very hard for us as Western Christians, I think, to understand Christians in a minority. Unless we've had experience with it in some place, China or somewhere, you know, where... And of course, they're a special minority here because they're not only a minority in a general national culture, they're a minority between two very powerful, though one small, but still very powerful, Israeli-Jewish culture and Arab-Muslim culture. Palestinian Christians, Arab Christians, make up no more than 5%, 6% of the population in any country. So they're between that rock and a hard place. They're between a rock and a hard place because they have had and are viewed even more so as having connections to the West. So in a way, they've always been viewed a little bit suspiciously by Muslims in that sense, that they have access to the West. Well, they could go to school in the West, or West would come and plant a school here. So there's always been a little uneasiness about that. And with the revival going on in Islam today, some of those tensions have become harder. They also have a problem, Palestinian Christians have the problem of at least some of the faith Christian faith groups being headed by non-locals. So the Greek Orthodox Church has a Greek as its head. Well, no, nothing against the Greek. Nothing against the Greek being able to try to understand Palestinians. But my guess is that a Palestinian head of the Greek Orthodox Church in Palestine would do a better job. Not any Palestinian. Or the Catholics. The Catholics have now finally, the Palestinian Catholics got their first Catholic Palestinian patriarch. And he's a marvelous man, Michel Saba. He wasn't in the job months, more than a few months before the Israelis were calling him a friend of terrorism. Why? Because the Italian who was there before didn't get involved that much. He wasn't connected as a Palestinian. He didn't speak as a Palestinian Christian. But Michel Saba, with all his vision of reconciliation, and it is powerful, it is central. I mean, he's a reconciler. But he's a reconciler in the way that Martin Luther King was, which is to say, you've got to speak truth. Reconciliation can't be based on lies. So when he speaks some truths that he needs to speak as a Palestinian Christian, he wrinkles the feathers of Israelis. But that's been another problem for Palestinians, that some of their leadership has been exterior. So it's a difficult circumstance, and it's, as long as the conflict goes on, these things are all exacerbated because they all play into suspicions and tensions and worries that people have. Now, in spite of all that, I mean, there are good things. I mean, Palestinian Christians have been very active in the Palestinian National Movement. Some of the foremost leaders of the movement have been Palestinian Christians, though not necessarily religious, still Christian. I mean. And highly respected people. Hanan Nasser, the president of Beer Zeit University, for example. An example that doesn't go well down in Jewish audiences, but I'll mention here, George Habash, the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. I mean, comes out of a Christian family. So it's a mix of things, but it's a hard way to go, and it's very important for American Christians to, when you go, spend time with Palestinian Christians and listen to their story. But it's also important not to come back and think that their story is the only story you have to tell. As if you then become a Palestinian here for them. Mm-hmm. Which has happened, I think, has happened to some people. They go out and they discover a Palestinian Christian and they come home talking as if they're a Palestinian Christian. No, you're not, you're an American Christian. You got Jewish neighbors, you gotta work with them, you gotta work with Muslims. So you gotta be sensitive. You gotta hear that voice and be able to speak about it, tell about it, but not act as if. It's like a white goes to the South or to a ghetto and comes back trying to speak as a black, you know? Uh-uh. You're white. Don't do that. Play the responsible role you need to play. We're over time, I think, already. But I appreciate your... I'm here until Saturday. The topic is... conflict is not going to be resolved before Saturday, so I invite you at a meal or something, we can continue the conversation. Thanks. Anyone who wants a card from the committee with my name, I'm one of the things...